Welcome to the fourth podcast for the blog Stuff Smart People Like. This week we want to start off acknowledging a suggestion from one of our two listeners who kind of want to know a little bit more about our backgrounds and what we do and why we do this. So I'll just say I'm Jordan Robinson, and I am currently a pre-doctoral intern specializing in neuropsychology at the VA and currently applying for postdocs after I finish up my PhD.
I'm Ed. I work by day as a research psychologist for a project at a university. I can't give a ton of detail about it, but it involves research in the correctional facility in the town where I live. And I'm basically like a statistical consultant, so I don't actually spend that much time in the jail. But my training is in social and personality psychology with a focus in methodology and statistics. And so that's what I do.
Hey everybody, this is Dean, and I studied theater in college, and I'm currently studying and performing sketch and improv comedy here in Chicago while I work a day job.
My name is Ben Alexander. I am sort of the resident tech nerd, and that's what I do in my day job, and most of my free time is I play around on computers. I support a school district. You can find me all over the internet at MrBenAlexander.com.
Okay, good. Yeah, so that's a little bit about our backgrounds, why, what we do. So going from that, we want to kind of get into our suggestions of the week, our smart suggestions of the week. So we'll kind of go around just in that same order again. Ed, what are you suggesting for our listener reader this week?
Well, I had one in mind, and then I changed it this morning because I saw a pretty neat video, and I'll post a link to this, but I'll try to describe it as best as I can. It's a video on YouTube describing how Japanese students are taught to do multiplication, and it basically involves, like, if you have two, like, say you're multiplying two-digit numbers together, like 21 and 23, you draw a series of cross-hatching lines based on what each digit is, and then you count the number of times that they cross each other, and you add it together, and it's pretty neat. I don't know, it's kind of like an interesting illustration of a different way to sort of work out math, versus the way that you learned probably in American schools, which I have forgotten actually at this point because I just use calculators. But it's a pretty neat video, and it's inappropriately titled How the Japanese Multiply, which I think might confuse a few people who come to the site expecting something else.
Oh, I usually look at other kind of videos from Japanese.
Well, yeah, I'm guessing some of those people got sucked in via links and stuff, and we're disappointed.
So I shouldn't be fooled. Okay.
Yeah, don't be fooled by that. But it's a neat. It might not work if you have really large digits. So if you're trying to multiply 999 times 989 or something like that, it would take a long time. But for different smaller digit, I don't know. It was neat. So I will. It's not well suited to talking about it via podcast, but I will post a link on the show notes for people to check it out.
Okay, sounds good. What about you, Dean? What are you suggesting this week?
So my suggestion isn't anything new in particular, but I think it's something that people would like to know about. Everybody is paying attention to Stephen Colbert and his second mock run for the presidency, or what he's calling the presidency of South Carolina, I believe, this time. What people may or may not know is that in 1968, a comedian named Pat Paulson also ran for the presidency. And Stephen Colbert's run mirrors his in a lot of ways. And if you want to see anything from Pat Paulson, you can go on YouTube. There's tons of clips. It started out as Paulson started out as a player on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and his run kind of started there. And then I think there was also a television special. And then he's done some subsequent things, I think, each election year since then, including, I believe, 2008. There's not a whole lot of information about that, but you can go to his website, which we'll post, and also look up stuff on YouTube. And he's just a really brilliant comedian doing what we might think is Stephen Colbert's shtick 30 years ago.
Okay. Sounds like a good plan.
Sorry, 40 years ago.
Yeah, really? Wow, man.
Oh, nothing's original these days.
No, nothing at all.
It all cycles around.
Right. But probably it's cool that you found that, Dean. Thanks.
Yeah. And like I said, he's probably the most talented player on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. If you happen to have those on DVD, you can see some of that.
And who doesn't?
Yeah, I have them on Betamax, but yeah. I could probably shift them over.
That's all right.
Okay. So moving on. What about you, Ben? What do you want people to see this week?
Well, one of the things I kind of this past week I've been doing was communicating with a lot of interesting, cool folks on Google Plus and other places. And one of the people I've been following brought it to my attention, this thing called the Wi-Fi QR Sharer. If you're familiar with QR codes, they're these kind of odd square barcodes, basically, that can contain all kinds of information, not just like numbers and letters. They can contain passwords. They can contain location information and graphics and everything, or hyperlinks. And in this case, Wi-Fi QR Share is designed specifically so that you can create personalized QR codes that you share either among your staff or like your friends and family if they're over to your house, that let you hook into their Wi-Fi without having to write down anything that's human readable. And it's by this company called Sudo Make Me an App, and they are, you know, real human beings, and I figured I'd give them a good shout out because this is a great little application, and this is for Android phones. So,
okay, very cool, very cool. I'm also gonna kind of go with D in a little bit. Not something that's terribly new, a little bit newer than the 60s though. I'm gonna do a music recommendation here. So I'm gonna recommend The Tallest Man on Earth. He's actually a singer-songwriter from Sweden, kind of been around since about 06 era. He's got two full-length EPs out, first one self-titled in 06, and then the last one in 2010. So just kind of great music. I think, you know, some of my favorite songs there, This Wind, The Gardener, King of Spain. I will put some of the links on that one kind of in our show notes, so you guys can check that out.
I can second that. I really like his music, and I would also recommend checking out the NPR Tiny Desk concert that he did, which is pretty – he's kind of an interesting voice and a way of delivering his music, and to see him do it in sort of like an intimate setting is kind of neat, and I think you can find that on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of, like I said, it's kind of like an interesting – style. I don't know if you guys know like Nick Drake. So he's kind of got a little bit of that folky kind of feel, like, you know, Bob Dylan-ish, but then a little bit newer with kind of like, you know, Nick Drake. So I don't know if that helps describe it or not.
Kind of like open chords and that kind of stuff. And
Ed, would you agree with personal. That kind of that feel?
Yeah, and the lyrics are really interesting. Specifically, like you mentioned, The Gardener. That song is it's about this guy like being kind of obsessed with this woman, and whether you take it literally or not, he's either killing people who might get in his way or make him seem lesser to her, or he's like killing his demons and burying them in his garden. So it's an interesting
song. That's a pretty good different read there. Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to share a story with you guys that I think maybe we've all had this experience before, but over the holidays when I was driving back from Michigan, which is about an 11-hour drive, I was using my phone to the GPS function. I have an Android phone. I was using it to get me back not only to DC but also to make sure I avoided the tolls, because the tolls are like $28 both ways, or not both ways, one way.
Wow.
Yeah. So this time when I came back, I sort of just plugged it in. I got on the road. I took off. It was getting, I left in the morning. By the time I was getting close to DC, I was in West Virginia. I was in like the hills of West Virginia, and I had never been this way before. It took me that way. And right, you know, it was probably like 7:30 at night. I'm up in these hills. It starts snowing.
Did you hear banjo music in the background?
Oh man, I did. Yeah. I'd never been in West Virginia, and I was kind of terrified. But I got up into the hills, and my phone said signal lost.
Oh, of course, yeah, in West Virginia, yeah.
Yeah. It completely. So I'm on this road. It's dark. It's snowing. I have no idea how I got there or how to get from there back to DC. And so my only option is to just keep following this road. So I followed it for about 15 more miles. until, and I was actually running low on gas too, so I got to the point where I stopped at this little gas station and kind of got that, like, got the eyes from all the people. It was like in one little town, and there's these people, and they're just like, they hang out at the gas station because it's all there. So right. They're like, you know, talking to each other, like staring at me and stuff. And I'm like trying to figure out what to do. And I was about ready to go into the place after I'd paid to like ask for directions on how to get somewhere. I wasn't actually even sure, like, if I take this road, where does it take me? And then my phone kicked back into GPS and it made me back home. But it kind of made me realize, like, that was kind of scary. And I think I just put, like, you know, 600 miles in the hands of a device that can fail me. And had no idea where I was going. So I don't know if this, if you guys have had a serious similar experiences, but like it was really, it was a little bit terrifying, and it made me realize how much I've relied on technology. And I used to be really good with directions, and now I just let my phone take me wherever I'm going. Like even places that are in town, they're only a few miles away. Rather than actually like learn how to get there, I just plug it in my phone.
Yeah, you don't want to risk it. You know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. So. But I mean, what's the worst thing that happens if you get lost? But I don't know if you guys have a similar experience where you feel like technology has in some ways sort of compartmentalized our intelligence or made us kind of like, my spelling skills are horrible now too, because I rely on spell check. And I used to actually be pretty good at spelling. As people who've read my posts can probably figure out, I make a lot of spelling errors. So I don't know. But I thought we could maybe talk about whether or not technology was making us more or less intelligent.
If I may jump in, one of my things, I don't know, just before I joined this podcast, my phone, my Android smartphone, totally just died on me. So I went back and I had to use my replacement phone, which was a tiny little Nokia thing that had no features. And I really did feel like I had lost something, and not lost something like, oh, my phone's gone. It was like, no, like, I don't think I can do some of the things I do. So it was one of those things where I kind of had to relearn sort of like, I know mainly it was like planning ahead. So either I'd have to look up directions before I went somewhere, or if I was going to make a change, I had to communicate directly among a couple people and all that sort of thing. So it definitely, I've been offloading my intelligence quite a bit to these things. And I did feel like I was worse off from it.
Yeah, Dean, I'll kind of defer to you. Do you have like a personal anecdote here?
Sure. I don't know if I have a personal anecdote about missing something, some feature of my intelligence, but I will say that I've noticed I work a job where I don't necessarily need to speak to anyone very often anymore, and I often wonder if my verbal skills have been diminished. Because I sit and listen to podcasts all day, which I think I've become a very good listener. But I wonder if my ability to speak extemporaneously has been negatively impacted by having email in order to communicate with all of my coworkers rather than actually having to go talk to them.
Interesting. Dean, just out of curiosity, I don't mean to totally derail this, but can you get in a little bit more specific about what you do, or is it totally like government work, like need to know?
No, it's just I do like a temp job where I I type things into databases all day, and I get requests from people, and I have to communicate with them about their requests,
like on email and stuff.
But I do it over email rather than.
It's basically like, have you ever seen Mad Men?
I practically live Mad Men.
Yeah, so it's kind of like that. So Dean's like one of those secretaries on that show.
Ooh,
this poor Scotch.
But you could be like Peggy. Although
a little less busty.
And then you could have an abortion, and John Hamm would take care of you.
Oh, if you know what he means.
A girl can dream.
I'm sorry.
Spoiler alert.
I don't believe that was an abortion. I believe she gave...
Oh, no, that's right. Yeah, she gave up. Oh, that's right. So not spoiler, misinformation.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, and
I'm just throwing you off.
Several kids away.
In season 5, Don Draper learns how to fly.
I'm sorry. Joan had the abortion. Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, anyway. Okay.
All right, Mad Men. Sweet.
Yes. So back to the intelligence and kind of this technology making us stupider. So I guess real basically starting out with, you know, we banter or bandy around this term of intelligence. And so I guess what do we mean in, I guess, the scientific world about intelligence? And generally when we talk about something like IQ, it's kind of measuring cognitive abilities that that we use in kind of our day-to-day world, right? So, you know, we might think about things like memory, verbal and visual reasoning, just semantic knowledge, like fund of information kind of things. And this is all stuff we can measure. And, you know, I guess theoretically these skills would predict some kind of like how well we're able to work in our day-to-day environment, like how successful we might be. Kind of like, you know, the better these cognitive skills are, the more situations you're able to navigate, the kind of the better able you are to do some of these things. So
they're not, but you know, the stuff we're talking about here is like very specific knowledge. These are more like if you're tested on an intelligence test, you're tested on like, say, spatial knowledge, right? Rather than tested on like, you know, something very specific, like getting from point A to point B or directions or whatever, right? It's like an applied version of spatial knowledge or whatever.
So it's a kind of complicated. So there's actually some recent research in Science that actually did look at like this kind of is technology making us stupid kind of thing, but they kind of looked at more memory. And so I guess kind of going farther back, there's this, most of our theories, and this is kind of borne out in the research too, is that our brains are what we call like cognitive misers, right? They're looking, our brains are pretty much, they're lazy. They want to use the least amount of effort that they can. It's trying to conserve as much as it can to use later. And so it won't tax itself doing kind of what it sees as like pointless things. So this is why we have things like stereotypes and schemas and heuristics. You know, if we had to look at every new object in our world and kind of evaluate it completely new, you know, just kind of looking at things on my desk. So if I see something that's like a pen or a pencil, I know what it is, even if it doesn't look like other pen or pencils I have, right? If it has that shape and that general feel, like that's kind of like a schema. You know, you have a schema for pens or writing utensils. Mm-hmm. If you had to approach each separate one in your life as it were this new novel object, you know, life would just be so exhausting. Like your brain would get overloaded with things in your environment.
Right. Well, I think this is it, you know, framing this as are we losing intelligence is more like, there's two reasons you develop a technology like GPS, right? Or for, mm-hmm. it's for like two different kinds of people. It's for like people who don't have the ability to begin with. So some people just are really horrible at finding their way places, or finding their way back from places or whatever. So that helps those people. So in a sense that enhances them in some way. Maybe it's not enhancing their intelligence, but it's giving them a skill they didn't have before or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it also is just to take a task that you normally would have to tax yourself with and get rid of it, right? So so it's like, well, you know, I usually have to spend, like Ben was saying, I usually have to spend time like looking up a direction and like preparing and everything. I could be spending that time doing something else. If I rely on this device, it does it for me. So this is kind of like, and I think you mentioned that Science article, they mentioned transactive memory or transactional memory. I don't remember what the term is.
Yeah, but transactive.
It's the basic idea that you, well, at least in that context, it's that you use other people as a means of like storing your information. So or your skills.
I guess that theory works in kind of like a dyadic relationship, like husband wife kind of thing, or you know,
or in partner, a team,
or a team. You know, yeah,
as a certain team, people you let people
do
be,
different. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
You remember certain things. You have certain skills, and that's kind of fits there. And you know, and that research kind of bore out is if you have an expectancy that you'll be either be able to access some kind of information, whether it's, you know, maybe just factual information, directions or whatnot, your brain won't put in the effort to encode it into memory. Mm-hmm. It kind of has this expectation that I can just look it up later, so I don't need to remember this now.
Right. So in a sense, instead of putting our skills into other people, oh, okay, you know, this guy knows about, you know, taxes or whatever, we're putting them into things, right? So, oh, Wikipedia has that information, so I don't need to, you know, I don't go to Phil, who knows a lot about philosophy, I just go look it up on Wikipedia, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah, it's so yeah, kind of that transactive memory instead of a person, you know, you just kind of refer into the cloud.
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, what are the implications of that then? Have more space in our memory, in our brains to absorb new things, or is it just, do we become reliant on it?
I think I can take that one. We take that space that's empty and we fill it with cat videos.
Something like that.
That's what I would expect.
Yeah. Well, we don't know if there's, like, there's no, I guess, limit. You know, there's probably some kind of limit to the knowledge you can store, but our semantic memory stores are fairly large, and we don't know what the limit is yet. So I guess it's not like, you know, it's not like you have to save that information. It's more of just the cognitive process to encode something. That's kind of encoding things is a fairly, I guess, cognitively demanding task, especially if it's complex information. So it's more of the fact like your brain just doesn't want to do things that it feels are kind of unnecessary. If you can kind of fit it into these heuristic schemas, or if it's something else where the knowledge is stored elsewhere, it'll rely on that instead. And this is kind of, you know, and this fits with, you know, if you hear something called like the Flynn effect, and it's this idea that IQs have been steadily increasing over time, although there's research saying that it's slowing down or actually even stopping in the past 20, 30 years. So kind of, I guess it would come up to this idea that if you gave someone from like the late 1800s an IQ test that we use today, they would really score in like the mentally retarded range. But not because they're mentally retarded. It's just like there's a different, we're kind of measuring it in a different way. You know, there's other kind of theories of that too, just kind of about, you know, increase in education, more stimulating environments, which is actually kind of borne out pretty well in the research, improved nutrition, those kind of things. So yeah, it's just kind of like, you know, it's, you're using different skill sets now. And so with that idea of intelligence being measuring these cognitive abilities that help you navigate the world, The world's different now. We're kind of using to a bigger or a lesser extent certain cognitive abilities to get through our world now. Mm-hmm. Growing up in the 1800s, you had to do different things to get by. And so the thing is, like, we're actually becoming more efficient cognitively at finding information.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah. Are we becoming better at critical thinking and problem solving now that we no longer have to rely on absolute knowledge of facts because we can look them up?
I guess that one I can't answer as well. I think that there's the research on that isn't borne out well yet. I think it's more of this finding information we are much more efficient at. And so we're taking in a lot more information than we ever used to in a variety of contexts. And we're more efficient at doing that, you know, as opposed to, you know, if you think about the information you can find in 10 minutes on the internet now, how long would it have taken you to go through a library and find that same information, like, you know, 30 years ago?
Yeah, right. With that card catalog in that library instead of like all card catalogs across all libraries. I mean, I'm sure, you know, Ed and Jordan, you guys take advantage of this every day.
Oh, yeah.
In a sense, you don't have to have just specific knowledge about my university and, like, you know, the few professors that surround me and maybe some, you know, neighboring universities. You have all of it, and you have all of the journals since the beginning of those journals. Mm-hmm. So,
and not only do you not have to look things up by subject, but you can look for specific phrases and specific words.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess my point of view, I guess my view of this kind of idea about technology make a summer, it's more of, you know, we're relying on technology in a different way. So it's kind of a complicated issue. It's not really making us dumber, because if you, you know, the thing is, if you actually measure people's memory for the most part, so when they kind of, with the implication that they have to remember something for later, you know, I don't think that, you know, we're going to be, I guess, lower. If, you know, you did a group study of, you know, if we could do this theoretically, measure people now and measure people from like 30 years ago, I don't think there's going to be like differences in memory.
Well, I guess
essentially.
But there's also a switch, right? So you have a certain amount of your attention and your memory directed towards things in your environment. Like you said, you know, 30 years ago, it was used for different things. So now I guess the question is, like, imagine a scenario where this goes on for a while, like we use more of technology to use, you know, to transact our memory or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then we lose it. Let's just say for whatever reason, the grid goes down. And aside from the fact that everybody pretty much be out in the street shooting each other or whatever, let's just say that didn't happen, but we had to like go. And, you know, I've heard people make the argument that like, well, like there was some guy, I can't remember his name, but he like tried to go out and live in the woods for a while. Like he tried to just like live off the land, and he came back after like a month and was like, screw it, you can't do it. I don't think people have the capability to like go out and like hunt their own food.
Well, what was his training though?
Yeah,
well,
right. That has there's plenty of people who are subsistence living. But
well,
anyway.
Yeah. No, it is. But I mean, I'm not saying right now. I'm just saying like, hypothetically, if this continues, I think the question is like, you know, if my phone breaks, do I feel a sense of loss? Like, there's a sense of like, I didn't realize that I was taking, like, you kind of feel like you know how to get somewhere because, like you said, you know how to do it. Like, I know how to take my phone and press the right buttons and get me to where I want to go. But, like, as soon as that is gone, you feel like part of your brain is missing. So it's kind of weird. You're carrying your brain around in this machine in your pocket, you know? It's kind of it's a little science fiction-y, but.
No, I like it. No, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, I also think it's interesting, if I can just throw back a little bit of history into this, going back, you know, only a couple thousand years, Socrates was against his words being written down. I think it's interesting. I've been reading this book, The Information Diet, which is actually really good. It came out in December. I just want to read this one line here just because it's a good plug for The Information Diet. But it speaks to kind of what we're afraid we're losing, and maybe we're not really losing it. And as Jordan says, we're really just optimizing and performing things differently. And it says Socrates was vehemently against the written word, and Socrates thought that the book would do terrible things to memories. Keeping knowledge in books and not in heads would be detrimental. So,
yeah.
And you know, we don't. No one has to be committed to just remembering the Bible or one passage of the Bible or the Iliad or any of those things. So, I think we're better off for that in a way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed.
But always have a map.
Yeah, always. Yeah, well, there's nothing to be. There's definitely something you said for redundancy. However you want to look at that. Either it's carry two phones, or you know, carry a phone and a map, or you know, your Swiss Army knife. You know, just be prepared. I think that's always a good thing to be doing. So,
mm-hmm. Or Ed, you could just somehow reclaim your Y chromosome sometime and just learn how to drive places without a GPS. Would you man up?
Ben, in the last podcast, you were mentioning something about hacktivism and its impact on things that happened in 2011, and a hacktivist group, Anonymous, just made the news this week. So I was wondering if you wanted to talk about that, and if you wanted to give us a kind of a brief overview of what happened with Anonymous and this website, Mega Upload.
Okay. Well, Mega Upload is a website that is designated or designed for uploading large files and sharing them via just regular URLs or links. And basically, it's been used for pretty much since its inception for violating copyright and sending movies and videos and albums and collections of things in kind of clandestine ways. And so finally, despite SOPA and PIPA and all those things not passing, strangely enough, justice does seem to work sometimes. And the Justice Department shut down Mega Upload and actually arrested a number of the staff members and that sort of thing. And in retaliation, the sort of amorphous group called Anonymous attacked a number of different intellectual property content holder websites and the Department of Justice and a few government websites, and did what are called distributed denial of service attacks, which are DDoS. And a DDoS basically pummels a website into not being able to serve its content to anyone. And so that's kind of where that stands. And right now, of course, in response, the Department of Justice and the FBI are trying to figure out who did what to try and shut down those websites. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the
and
kind of where
as far as DDoS goes, that's just where hackers essentially set up a way where they can access the site continually to stop.
Yeah. Well, it's not actually, I guess, hacking. So they're not actually hacking into anything, really, right?
Right. Yeah. In itself, what a DDoS is it's generally one of the simplest things on the planet as far as networking is involved, called pings, and other types of what are called requests. Every time you go to a website, it sends a request to, hey, can I see this website? Can I see this page? Can I send? Here's a password. Blah blah blah. So what it does is a DDoS is having thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of those things happening all at once and overwhelming any of the servers that are trying to provide that content. And when it overwhelms it, nobody can get anything. And so the site essentially appears to have disappeared off the web. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that sounds like what I had heard
yep.
it was.
Yep. No, definitely. And the thing is, though, Jordan was right. It's not really a very intricate thing in itself. It's essentially the equivalent. I like to think of it as like where there was a staged protest with the blackouts and stuff. This was like the internet running riot. So you just smash windows, you shut things down, you know things don't work anymore, and you send a whole lot of system admins across those companies and all across those organizations trying to figure out and fix things and make things back to normal. And unfortunately, in the case of Anonymous, they like to employ people who are otherwise innocent. So they use sort of like clickjacking and some other kind of ways to circumvent innocent users into participating in these denial of service attacks. So they tend to kind of, that's how they overwhelm the system of these very large sites.
Right. So they had previously done this, and when they had previously done it, it was volitional. So like if you clicked on the link, you knew what you were doing.
Right.
But this time around, from what I understand, they created these links and just posted them all over the place to try to goad people into accidentally clicking them and then basically unintentionally committing a crime. Because once you once you do that, it's a punishable crime.
Yeah, that's going to be one of the interesting things. I think Anonymous, in a way, was kind of clever. This was the part that was kind of clever. I mean, it's mean and definitely morally wrong. Or at least I think it's morally wrong. But one of the ways that they're probably going to try and get away with this is basically saying, there were, too many people were too innocent. We're all innocent of this thing, so they can't arrest us all. And most of us didn't really have anything to do with it, that kind of thing. So the DOJ has a lot to figure out here.
Yeah, so I guess that kind of leads go ahead, Ed.
Oh, I was just going to ask, does it differentiate between people legitimately trying to use a website at the same time that it was being, denied service?
The only difference would be a normal site would send a few versus a few hundred thousand, that kind of thing where it's like, there's a couple of people with like gardening hoses and then there's a couple of people who are just like blasting it. That's pretty much it.
Okay. Yeah. That's so,
the average user does not. Yeah, average users do not do this. The only thing is, if you set up, say, for example, on Tumblr, if you had set up a little sort of like misleading link that said, hey, get a $50 gift card to click this link and get a $50 gift card to Starbucks, a lot of people would click that link. Mm-hmm. But every time everybody's clicking that link, they're also inadvertently participating in this denial of service attack. And that's what's going to kind of help obscure the people who actually did the wrong thing. So anyway.
Yeah, I think that leads into the discussion of, I think Anonymous started out as kind of trying to, cultivate a little bit of this, like, Robin Hood kind of image. Like, we're kind of breaking the law, but we're doing it for the people, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is, they kind of are also set up to be this loosely based organization with kind of no set leadership and, no... I guess headquarters, that kind of thing. So it really opens the door for a lot of people to kind of use the moniker for a variety of things. And I'm just wondering, is this kind of, I guess in my view, I think it's hurting them a lot because in a lot of their kind of schemes and when they hack and get personal information, leak it, a lot of times they're doing this for like regular people. They've released personal information about police officers, just kind of run of the mill police officers.
Right.
And then when some of those, security sites were hacked, kind of just regular people working for these places. And so it's kind of, they've gone from, robbing the sheriff of Nottingham to pretty much like screwing over the citizens of Nottingham now. So I think, how do you feel like how do people feel like, because I guess now I kind of thought they were a little bit, kind of cool in the beginning, but now I think they're just kind of a bunch of kind of immature kids, really, for the most part.
I don't want to paint them with that brush necessarily. I think there's still a lot of the people involved in Anonymous, sort of at what could be considered its core, the people in things like Antisec, and some of the other groups are these little tiny, I guess they might be bunches or whatever they are, people who facilitate these sort of backdoor channel communications and sort of the ongoing thing. I think those people really do have a high level of sophistication. Their message really appeals to people who generally don't care about much of anything and kind of like making trouble. And the only thing is, whereas these people in, you know, previous generations would have basically stuck to, you know, petty vandalism and graffiti and that sort of thing, now they can hang out and they can at least take part in, you know, taking down the Department of Justice, or they can rat out police officers in San Francisco, which is one of the things that they were doing. And in Oakland, they, for some reason, a group of anonymous were particularly focused on getting people and the cops in trouble, basically, with, you know, by running them, you know, revealing their personal information, that sort of thing. So,
but were these kind of like police officers that had done something wrong, or just because they happen to be working for the police department?
I don't really know too many of the specifics. I know that some of the stuff that some of the police had done had been not necessarily good and had probably violated, you know, protesters' rights, especially with like the BART transit shutdown stuff.
Oh, yep.
And so that was, but the thing is that, again, I like to think of it as kind of like running riot on these things. So on the one hand, there might be a aspect that has a legitimate complaint or concern, but completely, you know, just is so completely, I'm losing my words here, but you know, it's like a riot. So everybody's going to get hurt and everybody's getting harmed. And the point of the whole thing was to sort of make a mess of things, to know how upset they are. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's, you know, throwing a tantrum.
Isn't this a sort of similar situation to any sort of group mind thinking, where when you have a group and even if at their core their intent is to do something good, that it can balloon out and their message can be, you know, manipulated and, you know, changed into something that isn't necessarily as good or that's bad? Maybe the psychologist in the room can.
Well, I think a little bit. I think there is that kind of that groupthink. But I think, and the thing is, they can't, in the way that they set this group up, like I said, no leadership, no headquarters, kind of anyone really being able to perpetrate these things kind of hurts that. It's, I think that they do have this potential to do like some, you know, expose some pretty great things and kind of force people to look at things in a certain way, or, you know, kind of bring these issues to light. But the fact that just the way that they're set up and anyone can kind of, you know, do some jackass things if they want to under the moniker. And then since they don't have like this leadership, they can't always necessarily say, oh, it wasn't us. Or sometimes they can say that, but then you don't know if it's just because they got a bad backlash from it or they didn't really do it. You just don't know.
No, they do. I mean, well, so they do have some sort of spokesmanship. Right. There are people who
kind of,
because there are times when people who have been members of Anonymous have done things and Anonymous has basically disowned them and said, no, we didn't. This was like a thing that they did and we didn't do this.
Is that because like after the fact of they needed to kind of, are they just doing damage? I guess that's what I guess I'm wary of. Are they really actually like doing these things, but then they need to do damage control when they get backlash from it?
It's possible that's why they're doing it. I don't know why they're doing it, but I know that they have publicly endorsed some things they've done and not others.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, the other funny thing is, I mean, as always, what I keep going back to sort of these, like, they're just sort of the crowd. Anonymous is sort of like, it can be any number of people who kind of choose to pick up the mantle or not. It's a kind of almost like an open source brand,
right?
You know, where anybody can sort of pick up that thing and do it under that name at any one time. And then I think there's actually some in affinity groups who do kind of stick to specific things. So for example, there was like the Project Chanology thing that was focused specifically at the Church of Scientology. And there was a pretty not particularly well-known one where members of, you know, who take up that anonymous mantle went after this government contract security agency called H.B. Gary and exposed a lot of their inefficiencies and fraud and wastefulness and stuff. And those things are handy, but it's unfortunate that these individuals have to do it under the moniker of a thing that otherwise is kind of this negative destructive force. So Yeah. I don't mean to throw like a total wrench in the gear there, but it's just such a big thing when you talk about Anonymous, because there's different parts and it doesn't really exist, and there's people and they don't, and
I think that's why it's such a hard thing to get a grip on.
It's a moving target.
It's hard to have a consistent, coherent, like you said, I can see some of the positives and some of the negatives, but it's like, you know, the positives might be some, like, you know, specific group within this non-group or whatever. So yeah, it's hard to, like you said, it's a complex thing, and I feel negative about some aspects, positive about some aspects, but because of the way they're set up, it's hard to really, you can't nail it down.
Anyway.
So, yeah. I thought that I might share some reader comments to close out the show.
We don't have anything else we want to talk about.
Yeah. So the one that you guys have already heard, it was on our podcast page, actually, because I'm stupid and I don't know how to put the podcast on our own blog to actually. So I have like a separate podcast page. It was from Sam in MPLS. And he identifies himself as one of our two listeners, and that wanted to give us some feedback. As Jordan mentioned earlier, you know, he wanted us to geek out a little bit more, so we hope that we did that. But he also mentioned some really interesting things about the caucus system and some of the things we missed. So one of the things that I didn't know is that in the caucus, candidates who have less than 15% of the voters in a precinct to get delegates at the state convention can actually work with a candidate to swap those voters into another precinct, which is kind of interesting. So if you got really low showing in that, you know, in that precinct, you can, one of the other candidates can swap their votes with you and improve their, you both kind of win in that sense that you're making a trade to get more delegates. And then also we missed was that, and I should say this is all the stuff we talked about in the last podcast, so in case anybody was confused about that. But we kind of dogged on voting uncommitted, but that it actually has a specific purpose, because in the rare event that they actually would have, if there's a brokered convention in the event that they have one, which doesn't happen very often, if you vote uncommitted, you're not tied to a specific candidate when that happens. At least that's my understanding. Right. So he says here that, you know, in 1992, uncommitted was a distant second to Tom Harkin, who was and still is the U.S. senator there. And he was the favorite to win Iowa, but there was no clear favorite at the time to win the nomination. And Bill Clinton wouldn't really get to the nomination until Super Tuesday. So it made sense for the people in Iowa to kind of hold back their vote in case they had a brokered convention that summer. And it hasn't really happened. It's only happened a handful of times. But there's a reason they're voting. They're not just voting it.
So it's kind of a strategy.
They're like withholding. Yeah, they're like withholding their vote until a later date. And then there's some more information about primary elections as well. So just glad to have listeners who are informed about these things tell us when we gloss over an issue. And just to know that there actually are people out there listening. And the other thing you guys haven't heard is I got an email, actually, from Mr. Elaine Charles. It says, "Greetings," and there are three exclamation points in the subject. "This proposal might come to you as a surprise, but believe me that I am in a transparent business. My name is Mr. Elaine Charles, and I work in the delivery department in a security company here in London. I feel quite safe dealing with you in this important business. I was on a routine inspection when I discovered a deposit in an account of 12 million... Oh, wait a second. No, this is spam. Never mind. Ugh. Sorry.
Oh, we don't actually get $20 million.
Yeah, I think we should go with it. I think we should do whatever he says.
He says, "We want to transfer this money into a safe foreign account abroad, but I don't know any foreigner whom I can trust. I know that this message will come to you as a surprise, as we don't know ourselves before. But be sure that it is
that
real.
That is so true.
And
I know myself.
A genuine
I've
business.
Never known myself before.
I'm still learning about myself.
I contact you believing that you will not let me down once the fund goes to you. Let me hear from you urgently by email." And he actually has a whole, there's a whole story here about the Prime Minister of Lebanon. I don't know. It sounds pretty legit. I mean, it's all in caps, but I think
it just means it's urgent.
Yeah. I'd be like, He's like grabbing by the scruff of the neck and just screaming at you. I have this money and well, I need your assistance.
Should I just reply and tell him thanks for listening to the podcast?
Sure. I'm not trustworthy, so you guys should probably take that if you want.
I don't know.
If you reply, is it going to go to like the Department of Justice or something?
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, right.
Is it a clickjacking?
Yeah, are you clickjacking? I think so.
So as we do at the end of the podcast usually, I should just start off by saying thank you for actually responding to us, Sam, and thank you for listening. And anyone else who is listening who would like to chime in, talk to us, reach us via all the normal channels, either on the blog, stuffsmartpplike.blogspot.com, on Twitter, at smartpplike, on Facebook, stuffsmartpeoplelike, and on Google+. Did I miss any, Ben?
I think that's it.
Yeah, and
what about
otherwise,
our MySpace page?
The MySpace page hasn't been working in a while. There's the glitter background and all that stuff. It's kind of outmoded. Really. Yeah.
Yeah, we can't get that
Friendster? We on Friendster?
Friendster?
I tried out Path. Path sucks. Don't do it.
Jeez.
You can find me anywhere, Ben Alexander, if you need it. So
Ben,
if you got any
Ben
questions,
can direct
shoot
you to
them
the right
me.
Place too.
Yep.
And another thing to know is that those feeds are now manned by our manager of social media relations, Mr. Ben Alexander.
That's
and
right.
There are lots of things on those feeds that you don't get through the podcast or.
Yep.
The
we like to share all kinds of stuff that we find on the web. So
yeah. So you
follow them.
Yeah. So that's it's another reason to follow. We're going to still have openings for nominations for a charity to partner with the blog and podcast. You can find that on the website. That ends January 31st. The Oscar nominations are set to come out next week. I think the 20th.
I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, so we're going to have an Oscar contest on the blog. So as soon as those come out, we will try to set up a situation where you can vote on each, and you can see how you did comparatively in terms of predicting the things. I think we might actually, in a podcast prior to that, we might release a few of our, maybe not all of our predictions for, technical categories or whatever, but we might do a few for, best picture and,
the bigs.
And best actor and all that kind of stuff. So you can listen to what we have to say and you can also do that. So anything else, guys?
I learned French just before the podcast.
Oh, like all of it?
Yeah, all of it.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Dean.
Gerard Depardieu. Sorry.
Huh. All right.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for listening to the Stuff Smart People Like, and we will see you on the internet.